Digital 410 Productions proudly presents the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast with your hosts, Dodd Abernathy, Jeff Copsetta, and Henry Sledge.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast, your favorite World War II-based podcast. And over the years and years and years and years past, I would usually start this episode off with the Eisenhower speech before the D-Day landings. And I actually had it prepped. I'm not going to lie to you, but we got so tangled up in what we're doing that we said, hey, let's just change things up a little bit. And speaking of changing things up a little bit, we're all back together as one big happy family. Joining us, as always, Mr. Jeff Copsetta. Jeff, how you doing tonight, sir?
Great. Happy 78th anniversary of D-Day.
And Mr. Henry Sledge, how you doing, sir?
Fantastic. Good to be here on June 6th. How could it be more appropriate?
And I'll give you the honors, Mr. Jeff Copsetta. Who is our guest we have tonight?
Yeah, absolutely. So I was thinking about how do we do a proper anniversary episode about that day of days. And, you know, we have some friends over there right now in Normandy, hanging out there and talking to some of the few veterans left. And
must be nice.
It kind of got me thinking, how many of these guys are really left? And, they're really starting to fade quick. And we talk about that a lot. And it's our job as reenactors and through this podcast and everything else that we do in our lives, to dedicate to the greatest generation that we got to keep their stories alive. And what better to keep their stories alive than the family members of those who have served. So tonight we have a really, really special guest. I've met him a few months ago. He's become a really good friend of mine. We're going to really get some work done here in the next couple months. I'll let him talk about that. But Mr. Ricky Todd Kearsley, who had multiple relatives serve in World War II, both European and Pacific theater. But I think the one we wanted to talk about tonight is his Uncle Wash. So without further ado, RT, thanks for being here, man. This is really cool. Like I said, very fitting way to celebrate D-Day with us tonight.
Welcome aboard, sir.
Wow. Thank you so much. Y'all are awesome. I really admire the work that you're doing to keep things alive, to keep the awareness going of, what actually happened and the people that were involved that did that in the greatest generation that laid the foundation for where we are today as far as Americans, and not just that, the free world, as far as that's concerned. And as we see in Ukraine and other places, the free struggle for the free world continues.
Yep.
And without relent. And we are relentless as far as our quest for freedom. My name is Ricky Todd Kearsley. My aunt and uncle were over there in Europe, in Britain, before the D-Day invasion. I'm making a film that's around their lives and that time period, and the things that happened, the pivotal changes as far as, our quest for freedom against the Axis powers. And also, coupled with that, the quest for freedom and the quest for justice within the United States and the evolution of what became the civil rights movement and other things that happened with that, that were coupled. The foundation of that, I truly believe, and my family members were testified to, is the military was the great equalizer, as it was proclaimed. And because all advancement, and for the first time, all, positive or negative or whatever assessment of a person's performance in their job was solely based upon their service and solely based upon what they brought in the line of duty. My aunt was my dad's older sister. My aunt Corrine was her given name, Corrine Kearsley. Her nickname was Choo Choo. She was about 5'4", 5'5", and she was a sergeant at Fort Dix, New Jersey, when my Uncle Wash was my future Uncle Wash was going through basic training, and all 6'3" of him, nice. From Virginia. She was from New York.
See, tall guys did exist back then. I'm 6 foot five. I said, see, tall guys did exist back then. I'm 6 foot five. I go to all these reenactments. You're too tall. Well, they would have never had you in the service.
Generation.
Yeah. But yeah, I'm always told you're too tall.
Taller as we go through the procession of generations.
It's all these preservatives.
But anyway, to make a long story short, they met initially in Fort Dix. They made impressions upon each other. And then months later, over in England, they met again. Right before the invasion. And that kind of sealed the deal with them, I guess, the second encounter. And he was assigned to, and this is as per my my cousins, he was a pathfinder. He was assigned to a pathfinder units. I think back then that you were assigned to units based upon your skills. It wasn't the thing like they do now as far as requests, like, you know, I want to do this or I want to do that. They told you what you were going to do.
Mm-hmm.
And based upon his athletic ability and his other abilities, he was given the MOS of being a pathfinder. Anyway, the movie that I'm making, it's called Eureka Beacons. After the Eureka Beacon transceivers that pathfinders deployed over in Normandy to guide the lead aircraft with the Rebecca receivers that were located inside of them to the drop zones for the 101st and the 82nd Airborne Brigades behind lines in Normandy. And the thing is that I have been engaging with certain organizations and with certain individuals. Today, as Jeff had mentioned, some very good friends of ours, new friends of mine. Jeff has known these gentlemen, ladies and gentlemen, for a real long time. The Liberty Jumpers.
Yep.
Jumped in Normandy at the actual drop zones where the original airborne troops were actually drop zones where they were actually deployed. And they do that on a commemorative basis every year and have for a very long time. Jeff would know more about it than I. How long have they been doing that, Jeff?
I think since the 60th anniversary, I want to say 04, I thought was their first jump, but I could be mistaken.
Wow. That's a long time. That's awesome.
Now, but, one of the questions I have, does Airborne beget Pathfinders or do you get, you know, do you become, when he said he basically was assigned to become a Pathfinder, had he already enlisted as a Airborne or did he just right out of boot camp and said, hey, you're going to Pathfinder, we're going to send you to jump school?
He was trained as an airborne infantry, and then once he got out of airborne infantry training at a jump school, they assigned him to that, I believe, from what I know. Okay, and I don't know a lot.
Sure,
I just know what my cousins have told me, who they were part of a military, or you know, their military family that traveled with him.
It's just interesting to try to think what skill set. I mean, obviously airborne is the best of the best. They're the elite of the elite, you know, at that time. You just wonder, okay, you got this group of guys who made the cut. They actually made it through airborne school and training, which we all know had a high dropout rate. It's just crazy to think what elite skill set that he have above the rest of these guys that said, you're going to the even more elite of the elite. Come with us. It's something like that's just kind of crazy to think about. It's like, this guy was such a badass. He was taken to be from the group of guys who's going to be behind enemy lines. You're going to go even further.
No, he's right.
Sometimes the army works like this. You. Let's go.
Right.
Exactly. Or as his family would like to believe, he was a bigger badass than the rest. They sent him out. Right.
I must make an addendum. I know our main topic and focus is D-Day and
no worries
and operate and the D-Day operations. Subsequently, in the Korean conflict, he was an airborne ranger. In 1954, he went to Indochina as one of the first advisors to what became the Military Assistance Command Vietnam and Special Operations Group, and then subsequently he was one of the first cadre of NCOs that trained and became the Green Berets. He ETS'd, exited his term of service as a Green Beret Master Sergeant.
As I said, he was the badass of the badasses. See, I was right.
the thing that is a really long, funny about my uncle is that is a he long was career. Just really big bear of a fun. He's kind of like a Yogi Bear kind of guy. He's like, hey, boo-boo.
Hey, boo-boo.
You know, kind of.
Got a picnic basket.
I remember in going to visit my aunt and uncle on holidays. We were up in, they settled eventually in Rochester, New York. And being in the backyard, shooting cans of gum out carburetor cleaner with tracer bullets and watching them explode when I was a preteen.
That's hilarious.
That's getting raised right.
Right?
No, that's awful specific. Not WD-40, not brake clean, gum out. Has a higher explosive content to it. That's fantastic. That's just such a long, not only is that such a long career, that's such a long career in a over physically beat up roles. I mean, all those years of jumping out of planes and doing special forces type operations. That's just a long haul, and over multiple different campaigns. It's just crazy.
Well, it's funny that you mentioned that, because one of the the focuses of the foci of the film that I'm producing is this, and it's in the script. It's also in the treatment, basically. Here, let me get a copy of this real quick. Oh, you know what? I gave that away. But it basically, because when he got it, went into the Army, when he enlisted, he was just this quiet, big, quiet, sweet kid from Virginia, from, you know, rural Virginia. And part of this story is his metamorphosis from this big, sweet, innocent kid into this professional, you know, NCO leader, fighter. And I hate to have to almost say it, I hope my cousins don't take offense to this, but you know, trained basically assassin, you know, and being able to disassociate and being able to compartmentalize that between the needs of duty and still be able to be that sweet guy that my aunt fell in love with.
Sure.
As anybody in that position has had to navigate and juxtapose and juggle. And that's part of the story, you know, as far as that's concerned. And the thing is that the whole nature of being thrust from, okay, you're over there, you're in England, you're in a safe place. Yes, you're training hard, you're doing this. All of a sudden you're across the channel, you're in enemy territory. Okay. And you're waiting for the rest of your force to come. You have the signals to guide them to where they need to be. And you're standing by to stand by, you know, in harm's way in enemy territory until they get there. And then you have to fight your way all the way through Europe to earn your ticket back home. And next to you, to your left, to your right, your friends are dying, being maimed beyond recognition, and all that goes along with that. And somehow, some way, you're coming through relatively unscathed on the outside, but you bear the scars of that on the inside. And, you know, it's the story of hundreds of thousands, technically millions of Americans, you know, in all the theaters of operation that we had.
RT, you mentioned a little bit before about these, the title of your film, Eureka Beacons, and I'm just going to assume, and I think it's a safe assumption, that there's listeners out there that have no idea exactly what these beacons were. And I know you don't maybe know exactly what your uncle Wash did, but can you give a little bit of an overview of what the Pathfinders had to do? You know, you mentioned kind of going in behind enemy lines, and this is before even the 82nd and 101st jumped in. So can you give kind of a brief overview of that technical skill that these Pathfinders did and how important it was to Operation Overlord?
Absolutely. Thanks, Jeff. Yes, the Eureka beacons were microwave devices that had been developed by the Allies originally for the deployment and the distribution of supplies to the French underground and to other underground organizations and to covert operators that were operating in Europe with the C-47 aircraft. The Eureka beacon system was a combination of two different devices. One was the Eureka beacon itself, which was basically a transmitter with an antenna. It transmitted in the baseband frequency of approximately 200 megahertz, I believe. And what it did was it was a transceiver. It transmitted a signal, and it also received a signal. So the C-47, which was the American cargo aircraft at the time, was fitted with what was called a Rebecca receiver. And the Rebecca receiver was a transceiver that would receive on the same frequency of the Eureka beacon and then retransmit back to the Eureka beacon. And what it did was it closed the gap and it measured the distance between the receiver and the transmitter. So the pilot inside the C-47 would know how far he was away from the drop zone where he was going to drop his supplies, or in this case, later with the airborne, his paratroops. So the job of the Pathfinders, which was pivotal to the success or failure of the D-Day invasion, was this. They had, I believe it was 8 teams of Pathfinders with Eureka Beacon transmitters that jumped into the drop zones that were going to be used for not only the airborne, but also the glider-based troops that were coming from England across the English Channel. And so what happened was the night before the D-Day invasion, these 8 teams of Pathfinders were dropped into Normandy, into their respective sectors where they were supposed to mark their drop zones for the D-Day invasion, set up their Eureka beacons, and at a particular time synchronized, turned their Eureka beacons on because the battery life only lasted so long on the actual Eureka beacon transceiver. And so they would have a specialist that was a Eureka beacon specialist and someone who assisted them. And the rest, there was an officer with them. And then the rest were troops that were there to maintain security on the perimeter of the drop zone where the Eureka beacon was deployed to keep the enemy from getting to it.
Now, did the Eureka beacon, what did it broadcast? Was it like a tone like in Aliens when the aliens were in the ceiling just got louder the closer they got? Or was it static? Obviously, they don't want to. I would assume they didn't just broadcast in English, hey, you're on your way, because the Germans might pick it up. What was it actually broadcasting?
It was a series, like it is back then. It was a series of tones. It was a totally analog device.
Sure.
It was a tube-driven, tube power supply. And the thing is that the RF radio frequency signal that it actually put out was a set of tones. And the thing is that the tones would get stronger and the frequency would become narrower as the Rebecca receiver in the C-47 approached the actual Eureka beacon.
Almost like a metal detector, sounds like.
Yeah,
pretty much. Getting... Very okay. Similar. Very like, similar. Yeah. Actually, excellent analogy.
Yep.
Excellent analogy, Jeff. Yes.
You know, it's so funny you say tube driven. A lot of our listeners are going to be too young to remember this because everything's solid state now. But that just goes to show you how delicate these things were. Could you imagine like jumping out on an airplane with your dad's like 1965 bass amp and not break those tubes and have that thing work when you like?
That's an awesome analogy.
Yeah, it's like anybody who's had a guitar amp or a bass amp, because my dad was in a band in the 70s and he had like custom bass amps and all these guitar amps, and they all had tubes in them. You could turn them on, you'd see them that glow. The thought of that thing, and that goes to show they probably had to wrap the hell out of it with something to help soften the blow if that thing came down too hard and break those tubes. And well hopefully the ones in my haversack, assuming they didn't break either.
Actual bag that they had they used to deploy it was specially designed for the actual actual transceiver for the set. It was a box about yay big, and it was in a like a canvas bag. I had a picture of one.
When it comes to planning out your movie and kind of your screenplay, you know, the Pathfinders isn't something that everybody and their grandmother presents content about. How did you go about researching and getting all the information and the details for writing your storyline and your script?
I'm still doing some of the research. I basically found a lot of stuff online. Let's see. I also have a friend of mine who he was in Bosnia, and he was an airborne ranger and Pathfinder, mind you, in modern day.
Sure.
I got a lot of information from him. He was my best friend's younger brother when we were growing up, and he was stationed at Fort Campbell, Kentucky.
Gotcha.
So I got a lot of information from him. And the rest of it, it's available. If you go online, you can read it. Just type in Eureka Beacons, and there are a number of different links that'll take you to information. They even make reissued Eureka Beacons that you can actually buy, that reenactment groups actually utilize.
Very cool. Do you feel comfortable? What's the working title of the project if you're ready to release that sort of thing?
Oh, no. The working title is called : Eureka Beacons. I've thought about shortening it to Beacons because of the nature of, you know, something, a beacon, something that like in aviation, you've got, the beacon light at an airport, sure. You know, the green and white light that spins around. So, you know, it's a point of, it's a nexus of things where things so come together, converge, or draws attention. Some, you know, like a beacon, like, you know, like, you know, similar to like a lighthouse.
Yeah. It could be semi-metaphorical as well.
Absolutely. Exactly. Exactly.
Well,
the working title is Eureka Beacons. And, I'm basically financing this out of my pocket. I have an okay financial shovel. I work as a broadcast engineer.
I'm sorry.
I
said, I'm sorry. No, I'm just, I worked in terrestrial radio for 6 years. That's all.
Yeah. I work in network sports. I do at this point in my career, I do golf. And the importance of sports in broadcast is inversely proportionate to the size of the ball.
Mm-hmm.
So golf being the pinnacle. So I get paid, taken care of pretty well. So I'm putting my money into making this film.
Are people still doing like the Kickstarters and things for movies? I know that was bigger back in the day.
Yeah, they're doing that. And I'm going to do a GoFundMe, but I'm not going to publish the GoFundMe accentuate that until I finish shooting the short.
Yeah.
And the short's going to cost, it's probably going to cost between 30 and 60 grand. So, you know, I'm going to put into it. I do have several things in my favor. I'm an aerial photographer with about 20 years of experience.
Nice.
So I started shooting news for Fox and for NBC in New York back before the turn of the millennium.
Back before we had drones.
For a period of time. Then I got into sports in 2003.
Fantastic.
Yeah. So I'm fully versed in doing that and have done a lot of production over the decades. with what I do. I originally started music when I got out of college. I used to tour with large bands doing audio, so I have a full, and then I ended up being a recording engineer in New York, and then 9/11 happened while I was there, and I got downsized into doing TV.
Yeah.
Hey, can I jump in real quick?
Absolutely.
Ricky Todd, is that you right there?
I've never seen that man before in my life. No, that's me.
Guys, I'm going to put in a plug for our guest here. Ricky Todd, I listened to your album today at work.
You did?
Yes, I did. And I was very impressed.
Oh, my God, really?
I'm a music guy, man. And Jeff was coming over the wire talking about asking you to come on. And I'm like, so I started kind of looking you up because I like to know who's come on, you know, so I can be somewhat versed. And I listen to music on Spotify, usually punk rock, heavy metal, that kind of stuff. But I saw you on there and I'm like, that's the guy, man. And then your biopic, it looks like you're sitting in the cockpit of a B-25 or something.
B-17.
It's a B-17. Okay.
Yeah, well, that's aluminum overcast. Yeah, okay. That's aluminum overcast. There's a story behind that. My aunt, the one I was telling you about, my dad's eldest sister, the one who's 99 years old.
Yeah.
During World War II, she worked at Republic Aircraft in Long Island and built P-51 Mustangs.
Wow.
Okay.
So anybody who's worked on P-51 Mustangs gets a free ride to B-17 by the Eastern Aeronautical Association, because they basically said, well, if you didn't do your job, this airplane wouldn't be here.
Sure.
Yeah.
Probably.
Wow. Well, I'm serious. It's a good album. I listened to every bit of it and I enjoyed it.
Thank you.
What genre of music would you say it is for
country
our listeners?
Country music, man. Country music. Isn't that right, RT?
Yeehaw! Where do I live? I live in Austin, Texas. I grew up in a little hick town at the end of a dirt road. And yes, I used to teach people how to ride horses a long time ago. I met a girl when I was a senior in high school.
Was it Laura Ann?
Yep. Well, no, her dad was the chief defense counsel. Her dad at the time was the chief judge advocate at West Point.
Okay.
And, I followed her down to Austin. I got here as soon as I could.
Well, the name of the album is Without You Guys. Give it a spin. It's a good album.
I'll have to check that out. So, we'll
sorry, I didn't mean to jump in there, but
you're more than welcome.
Sledgehammer, you're awesome.
You're more than welcome
to
jump in.
To Bobby Sledge?
No, sir.
He lives in Austin. He's an old friend of mine.
Okay. Not that I know of.
We'll include the link on the website, WTSPWorldWar2.com.
I'm not just saying that, man. It's a damn good album. I listened to it at work today and enjoyed it thoroughly.
What was your favorite song?
Let me see. I got it right here. I would say I thought One More Minute, the first cut.
Really?
I like the rhythm.
That's about that. I used to, when I was trying to, when I got out of doing sound reinforcement, doing music stuff, my first job in television was I drove a tractor trailer that pulled a satellite trailer behind it back when they were that big, before they had miniaturized everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like 1988. In fact, I came home from doing a fight in Las Vegas and my she goes by a different name, so we'll keep that because out of the media. But her water broke right after I got to. We went out to dinner at Taco Cabana. That was one of our favorite places to go and eat back in the 80s, back here in Austin, when it was still the sleepy little college town that it was.
You know,
yeah. Man, y'all are making mine up.
I was hoping, because I was like, man, I may be stepping in here.
He's about to put his foot in his mouth live.
Looks like Ricky Todd. And then
he used to work at Intel.
No. My wife would say I have nothing to do with intelligence.
Oh, I know better. I know better than that.
Do you have any social media footprints people can go check out to get an update on your project and how it's coming along?
Yes, I do. I have the URL. I secured the URL for eurekabeacons.com. And I am in the process of building a website with all of the information from Eureka Beacons and all of the production notes from Eureka Beacons. I've worked here. I want to pull something up and I'll just show you on my phone.
Sure.
I work as a video engineer on the side from the company that I work for. I actually work for a large company that builds stuff. But the thing is that, and the company I work for is, it's called Diversified Systems. They're a very large systems integration company. I'm actually an electrical engineer.
Nice.
By education. And
that's my father is
engineer for them. Here in Austin, one of our a couple projects, we built the Q2 stadium, did all the broadcast systems integration and a large Jumbotron, monitors and all the other stuff there. We just finished building the Moody Center at the University of Texas at Austin to replace the Frank Irwin Center, which is soon going to be imploded. And they're going to expand medical school there. We did all the broadcast systems integration there. We also did all of the RF and all the broadcast systems integration at the Circuit of the Americas racetrack. The thing is that, what was the point I was trying to get to? I think my train of thought got derailed. Hold on. All right. I work as a video engineer freelance for a couple of different organizations and stuff on the side. And one of the things that we do, here, I'll show you. This is one of the, let's see, want to not get too far off track, but I did want to show you this. For Eureka Beacons, I happened to be working in one of the screening rooms. I worked the South by Southwest Film Festival.
Sure.
And, also being a filmmaker, I just kind of always have my ears kind of perked up. You know, it's like paying attention, you know, trying to, just be there at the right time in the right place. And I happened to be in the screening room for this one particular production. It's a new show on Netflix called The Man Who Fell to Earth.
Okay.
The female lead in that production was a woman named Naomi Harris. Naomi Harris was in the movies Skyfall and Spectre. She's a Bond girl.
Mm-hmm.
And that's her.
Nice.
And me. We met. And I told her about my treatment and that I'm working on a short and a feature, and she had her agent there, and she told her agent to give me her email address. Another person that was in that production is somebody who I really liked as an actor, and he was on another show called Westworld.
Yep.
He was also in House of Cards.
Okay. A
guy named Jimmy Simpson.
Oh, yeah.
And he did the same thing. I told him about my production, and he gave me his agent's information.
Fantastic.
So I am confident that if I can do a real good job producing this thing and knocking it out of the park as far as the short is concerned, I'll be able to get funding to actually make the feature. And what I really would like to do after the feature, I'd like to spin this off into a series.
There you go. Just put Jeff on the poster and you're good to go.
American military family.
Yep.
And the thing is, it's a positive show. It would be a positive. It's a positive topic. It's inspirational. It's hopeful. And I think we need more programming like that out there. I'm not a big TV person, but I am a TV person in the production sense that I'm a professional that does this stuff. And that's just an observation, that I've made. And the conclusion that I've deduced.
I want to, before we change subjects, because I know we're going to talk about Henry's uncle, but just because you're here and you're the only one who'll enjoy this because of what you do and the line of work you're in. When I worked in radio, they were switching from the Marty over to the Comrex. Familiar with the Comrex? Little portable guy?
Oh, yeah.
And, you know how radio stations are. They hate change anything, but when they do, they go all out. But some might suggest you might want to do a little research. At the time, we were having these festival concerts here in town. And they just don't even take the Marty. That's old school. Leave the Marty back at the station. Take the Comrex. Comrex is fine. When they were broadcasting in the morning, there was 50 people walking around, 100 people rocking around. By late afternoon, when we're trying to interview Dave Mustaine from Megadeth, and you got 16,000 cell phones out in front of you, guess what doesn't work? The device that uses cell phone technology.
No bandwidth.
There's no bandwidth because you had 16,000 cell phones right in front of your booth. You're using this new technology that uses cell phone signals. The air was flooded. If we had the Marty in the truck, could have set that bad boy up, problem solved. Right. But they put all their, they, you know, oh, Comrex is the way to go. Well, that's great until your bandwidth flooded with too much.
Right, time. Until you've got 50,000 cell phones within 300 yards of where you're transmitting. I have a Dave Mustaine story for you. I used to ride on the bus with Dave Mustaine. I went out to fix a lighting console on Alice Cooper's Nightmare Returns tour.
Okay.
Back in 1987, 88. And Dave Mustaine, Megadeth was the warm-up band for Alice Cooper.
That's so, a bit of a, I mean, hypothetically, it doesn't sound like a juxtaposition, but when the actual physical music goes, that's such a different part of the spectrum from the Alice's music versus early Megadeth from, you know, Peace Sells and Who's Buying, or, you know, So Far So Good,
right,
So What.
Right.
That's a huge difference.
Great guy. He's real nice.
But now, Henry, everybody, we know we've talked a lot about your father on the show, and you've mentioned your uncle, and we thought what a better time to get a little more into what your uncle's contribution to the war effort was than to do it on the anniversary of D-Day. So I'm going to shut up and quit talking now and hand it over to you, sir.
Well, I mean, I really didn't want to turn this into the center stage because RT's our guest, but I do want to say this. So this was my dad, obviously, but my uncle Edward, at the end of the war, him and my dad. So he got a Silver Star on D-Day.
Jesus.
What I'd like to do is read his citation. He was a Sherman tank platoon commander. So I will read this citation. First Lieutenant Edward S. Sledge, Infantry, 741st Tank Battalion, United States Army, for gallantry in action during the Allied assault on the coast near Vireville-sur-Mer, France, 6 June 1944. First Lieutenant Sledge, a platoon leader, landed with the initial assault wave under intense enemy machine gun, mortar, and artillery fire. In the absence of his company commander, he assumed command of the company. When his radio failed, there was no way to give commands from one tank to another. First Lieutenant Sledge, dismounting from his tank, went along the open beach to four other tanks, giving instructions to the operators. Re-entering his own tank, he proceeded down the beach until it was immobilized. While lying in a relatively safe position, First Lieutenant Sledge, seeing a wounded soldier about 25 yards away, crawled to him and dragged him back to cover where he was given first aid. The courage and determination of First Lieutenant Sledge in acting with complete disregard for his personal safety in order to assist to the utmost in the assault depicts a gallantry that is a credit to himself and the military service, intermilitary service from Mobile, Alabama. And my Uncle Edward ended up, he was a graduate of the Citadel. He ended up finishing the war. He fought all the way across, got the Bronze Star in the Battle of the Bulge and three Purple Hearts.
Hold on. I want to pause real quick. What you just read, if someone was watching a movie like Fury or a World War Hollywood production and the main character did exactly what your uncle did, there would be people watching saying, please, that would never.
They wouldn't have done that.
What you just read just is so mind-blowing that, you know, you hear the phrase sometimes truth is stranger than fiction. Well, sometimes truth is hardcore than fiction. Yeah, like Jeff, if Ricky was writing that into his screenplay, people are like, what is he ramp? That's just insane, Henry, to think. And clearly, and we know from doing the research and reading books, those awards weren't just handed out. There's actually plenty of stories where people didn't get awards because, quote unquote, there's too many being handed out for that campaign. So the fact that somebody witnessed that, reported it, and it was confirmed by enough other witnesses to be approved and go through just goes to show you that wasn't nonsense, that truly happened. And that's just insane.
I actually, when we get on into December, I'll read his Bronze Star citation because it's pretty cool what he got in the Bulge. But John McManus actually, so when 741st landed on D-Day, they were attached to the Big Red One, the 1st Infantry Division.
Yeah, buddy.
And John McManus actually wrote something about that, including about my uncle, into his book on the Big Red One. But he sent me the combat action report here, where it was actually a teller mine that Edward's tank ran over that knocked it out.
Wow.
So it's pretty cool to see the combat report with a paragraph describing how they fired on enemy gun emplacements and that kind of thing.
And how old was he?
He was 2 years older than my dad. So I think he was 24 at this time. No, he would have been 23 right here. 22, 23.
It's just, it's always mind-boggling to think of what all these guys did at such a young age compared to what we try to get 20-year-olds to do nowadays, or 18-year-olds or 16-year-olds. What do you mean I got to get a full-time job? I'll settle for a part-time job at this point. You got to do something, kid. But just, it's just always so mind-blowing that how things are just so different and just good to go. But but continue on. I just wanted to pause there because I didn't want to just brush over what he actually did, because just sitting back listening to it as you read, I'm just like, I'm seeing it in my mind.
I hate to take up the time to do it, but I could read this little paragraph from the AAR.
I don't think anybody would object.
Read it. Yeah. All right.
Okay. So this was the AAR. It's got a lot of paragraphs here. Just the one. It says, First Lieutenant Edward S. Sledge, the second report, Able Company, 6 June. Lieutenant Sledge of A Company landed at 0635 hours vicinity of Easy One with his platoon. One tank under Staff Sergeant Cart destroyed just minutes after debarking. Lieutenant McDonough and Lieutenant Sledge's tank fired on two emplaced French 75-millimeter guns on hill at left flank of Fox Green. Claim credit for destruction of guns at 0715 hours. Infantry pinned down by enemy machine gun and sniper fire from the same position. Tanks could not locate these targets from beach, but could not advance due to minefields. Upon assault of C Company, 16th, that's got to be 16th Infantry Regiment, on this hill moving up Easy One exit. Upon assault of C Company, 16th Infantry on this hill by flanking, moving up Easy One exit, four tanks, Lieutenant Sledge, McDonough, Sergeant Carlson, Sergeant Ryman, moved west on beach to cover this advance. Tank of Lieutenant Sledge hit Teller Mine at this time and knocked out of action. Tank of Lieutenant McDonough hit in gas tank by 88 millimeter and burned. Sergeant Ryman's tank brought fire to bear on machine gun positions on Easy One exit. One DD direct drive tank destroyed and burned by enemy 88 millimeter located in pillbox on west slope of Easy One exit. Tank under Sergeant Carlson claims credit for silencing gun. Does not believe gun completely destroyed, but did not fire further. Tank of Sergeant Carlson threw track and temporarily put out of action. Crew evacuated tank under mortar fire. And that's the end of that paragraph.
That's a lot of action in one paragraph. Do you know if any of the tanks in your uncle's battalion were offloaded using the amphibious skirts, or were they all offloaded from LSTs?
I will tell you, Don, that is a great question, and I can't answer it tonight, but if we could circle back around at a future episode, because so Cornelius Ryan, who wrote The Longest Day or Bridge Too Far, he sent a questionnaire, and John McManus sent it to me, a questionnaire. Apparently, he had records of every veteran, you know, who was there, and he sent a questionnaire to my uncle, and it's photographs of it. I don't have the actual copy, where Edward filled it out. And a lot of those questions are gone into. And if I know we could talk about it at a future episode, sure, I'll try to like transcribe it. Cause you know, it's type questions by Cornelius Ryan
and then pencil and writing,
handwriting,
yeah,
which is not real easy to read, but it is legible. But yeah, I mean, he goes into a lot of that detail.
Cause it's, you know, I was saying about this earlier when we were talking about the Eureka systems. One of the things that maybe I think we as historians and reenactors, we think about, but I don't think the general public think about, World War II, at least by the time D-Day rolled around, obviously August 7, 19, you know, when the Marines landed on Guadalcanal is a little different. We were still using weapons from World War I. But by the time the D-Day rolled around, it was basically a war of new technology. Okay, we need to figure out how to land these tanks through the water. I know. Let's put a 7-foot-tall canvas shower curtain around it. It'll be buoyant enough, and we're good to go. Or here's some new rifles. Let's drop a bunch of paratroopers, which, by the way, paratrooping was a brand-new experience. It was, you know, they had their first jumps in Africa and Italy. But, you know, so it was relatively new. We got these new Eureka beacon systems that they're tube-powered. They run off of some batteries and yeah, they'll work. So a lot of this stuff was done with brand new technology that not only didn't exist before the war, but the war actually made the technology exist. And the amount of effort and victory that came out of new tactics, new equipment, new everything, was just astounding to think about.
Don, that's the sheer guts of the Greatest Generation.
Yeah.
That's the common denominator there. It's the sheer guts of Ricky's uncle, of Henry's father, Henry's uncle, and so many others. Because, yeah, you're right. I mean, it's the motherhood of all invention.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you can test fit things all you want, but it takes somebody to get it in the air, put it on the ground, or stick it in the water, and you know, the baptism by fire. And that's what's so great about this, because it was, you know, done by man. I think that's the greatest part of the Second World War. Yeah, there's a lot of technology that came out of it, and a lot of technology that we enjoy in our homes today because of it. But it was still the man in the cockpit, the man in the tank, the man wearing the boots that made it.
Now,
yeah, exactly.
For those of you watching on YouTube or watching the restream later, Jeff is wearing, I believe, I can't see the bottom of his pockets. I think he's wearing the M42, or is that the M41?
It's 42. Yeah, I'm getting ready for wardrobe for Ricky's movie.
So
yeah, and you're doing a damn good job.
The reason, I see the reinforced the elbow. So he's wearing the M42. Now, if you think about it, hypothetically, one can make the argument that that was kind of the first real battle uniform, because that uniform was designed for airborne. And we've talked about this in the past. D-Day. It's also blows my mind to think that, especially the infantry, they landed in their Sunday best. When they landed on the beaches of Normandy, with the exception of obviously their helmet, their web belt, and their backpacks, and their rifle, and their leggings, they're wearing what their parents wore to work every day. They're wearing wool trousers, a button-up shirt, sometimes a tie, a cotton jacket, and that's it. They didn't have combat uniforms with special pockets. They're wearing wool trousers, a button-up. They're literally wearing what they would have been wearing at home to college, with the exception of a helmet, web gear, some leggings, and a rifle. We're good to go. It's just – that's the other thing. That just – it's a battle of necessity. Here you go. Here's a nice cotton jacket and some leggings. Keep your boots from getting sucked off in the sand. Good luck.
It's just, if I might add Jeff, that uniform basically speaks to a prototype and predecessor of what would now be considered the battle dress, the BDU uniform.
Absolutely.
One of the most comfortable things I've ever slept in.
I was getting ready to say, I have that uniform. I have P-41s, P-42s. I have HBTs. That is, without a doubt, the most comfortable World War II uniform. It just fits in all the right spots. It truly does. That is my favorite uniform to wear on a long weekend.
I thought you were talking about the Woodland camo BDUs, like what we were issued in the 80s and 90s. That's what I thought of when you said that. So yeah, I was probably one of the last guys to be issued a BDU uniform in 2001, because everything went, you know, desert. And
right, they changed it. Yeah, I remember those uniforms. And, yeah,
yeah. I still have a few of mine. Yeah, the green, brown, and black.
Yeah. Well, I think it's that time of the episode. Ricky, we need to talk production. I don't have sounders. I don't have opener. I need to find times, but we need to make a sounder for this part of the show, which is book reviews. What are we reading? What's in our library? So I'll put that on my list. I'll get into, now that I got my console built, I'll make openers and stingers and backgrounds and bumpers and all that good stuff. But Jeff, why don't you kick it off this week on what you're reading?
Well, I'm still reading the book, and I'm taking it slow because it's such a good book. I don't want it to end. Yeah, so I'm kind of taking it slow with it. Plus, I'm kind of swamped in schoolwork too for my degree. But I'm still reading Martin Caden's Flying Forts. It's just, I'm a little over 100 pages into it, and I'm still at the point where the Air Corps just issued or ordered, I want to say, 18 B-17B models.
Oh, wow.
So it is really the all encompassing of, you know, the Y1B or the Model 299, the Y1B17, Y1B17A, all that. And just how that whole project was almost canceled from the beginning. I mean, Boeing just kept hitting, speed bump after speed bump. They're going totally broke, trying to prove. And of course, the Air Corps is embracing it because the Air Corps is really trying to stand out. And, of course, this is in the late 30s. So they're playing the card that this is more of a shore defense weapon that we can reach out. You know, your coastal artillery can't reach out 700 miles into the ocean and knock out, you know, the threat from the air. So it's really interesting to see how the top brass and the Army is just like, you know, you fly boys are just crazy. We don't need four engine bombers. We have this B-18 bomber, this twin engine, total abortion of an aircraft, you know, just totally flawed. But, you know, that's what they were sticking to. The Army's good at sticking to its guns. So it's interesting to kind of see how the B-17 almost never happened. So I'm still reading that, but I did want to mention, how about a couple movie, recommendations, over Memorial Day weekend. You know, if I'm watching TV, it's very rare. It's mm-hmm. either going to be a hockey game or Turner Classic Movies.
Let's and go Pens.
Of course, through, what's that?
I said, let's go Pens.
Yeah, my Rangers took care of your Pens in the first round.
It happens.
They're working on taking out Tampa Bay right now.
That's my secondary team. I'll tell you what, Tampa Bay has a fantastic arena. Amalie Arena.
I used to do a lot of hockey, so as a broadcast engineer, and you talk about Pens like the Penguins?
Yes, sir.
Oh no, I did.
No, I'm talking about Tampa Bay's arena because Tampa. I live in Florida, so Tampa Bay's
and
arena.
I've done so many Ranger games for Game Creek Video in Legend,
Madison Square Garden.
Oh God, yeah, I've also done Hurricanes down here. My girlfriend she works for the Hornets doing basketball. She just landed over there in at Heathrow. She's on her way to Greece right now.
Nice.
But wow. but talking about Americans heading over there.
Right.
her dad was an Army translator in Vietnam. So anyway. So, but yeah, all of the hockey that's going on. I used to do a lot of that.
What movie were you going to suggest, Jeff?
What's that?
What movie were you going to suggest?
Yeah, so, you know, Turner Classic Movies had all the war movies all through Memorial Day weekend, so I just, like, hit record everything. And so there was three I wanted to briefly mention. One I just haven't seen in a while. I haven't seen since I was a kid, and I kind of forgot how good of a movie it was, 30 Seconds Over Tokyo with Van Johnson and Spencer Tracy. I mean, it's produced during the war.
Yeah.
And, you know, to show footage of the cranes, you know, picking up the B-25s to put it on the aircraft carrier. And, you know, I know they can use a lot of, you know, standard stock footage from the Air Corps of B-25s in flight, whatever, but it's just so well done. It's just really, really well done. And for it to be done during the war, I think it came out in 44. So they go into depth about the Chinese and how they helped our bomber crews. And, you know, we know that an estimated, I think, 250,000 Chinese were wiped out, you know, just because of the suspicion that they were helping us. Mm-hmm. It's just, and that they're kind of like, this is exactly how they did it. You know, right. It kind of blew my mind. So go back and rewatch that one. It's really, really well done. And then of course, you know, my son had one of his buddies over, and of course they're all up and coming reenactors. So the other day, we watched The Longest Day. And you know, it is what it is.
The Longest Thompson.
It's a good one. You know, if you got 2.5 weeks to put aside, watch The Longest Day. And then Objective Burma. Now
that's a new one on me.
So I didn't know what to think going into it because number one, I'd really never heard of it. So I recorded it, whatever, looked cool. It's so much more than I ever thought it was going to be. Another wartime production. My man, Errol Flynn, stars in it. And again, of course, when I first saw that, I went, swashbuckling tale of Errol Flynn killing everybody and wooing all the ladies,
complete with mustache oil.
Pay for, right? But this is done in 1944, so it's a very mature Errol Flynn. He plays a captain of the paratroopers that jump into Burma, the army, you know, the army paratroopers, and You're going to see some other guys that you recognize, especially if you've ever watched Sands of Iwo Jima. You're going to recognize two actors from Sands of Iwo Jima. But it's just such a great story. I don't know enough about it to know how accurate it is, but it's just a great tale of a small band of paratroopers jumping in to knock out a Japanese radar station that the Air Corps refused to knock out because they didn't exactly know where it was. So they inserted these guys, kind of like these Pathfinders, kind of like what, you know, RT had talked about, just kind of a couple teams of guys to go in, led by this captain, played by Errol Flynn. And naturally, they cannot get picked up because the airfield's, you know, swarming with Japanese. So it's a story of survival as, you know, just a handful of guys are trying to escape Burma and having to march out of there. It's like 200 miles of terrain. Really well done, called Objective Burma. So yeah, those are some of my recommendations. And what I appreciated at the very end of that film was this story has no has a conclusion, but it has no end. The end will be when the Japanese are, you know, the Japanese Empire is completely wiped out. Again, right. It's done in 44. That's fantastic. So
Henry,
good stuff. The year for the war after that, my uncle Chester was in Burma in the army, and he lived with us at the end of his life. Used to work at the VA hospital. My mom worked at as a RN, and he had earned 3 Purple Hearts there. And he used to sometimes sit around without a shirt on, and you could see, I guess, where he had gotten bayoneted and this and that in his abdomen. Yeah.
Speaking of Burma, one of the books I got to reading up on, I want to do some more on. We all know about the Edson Raiders, but the Merrill Marauders. That's some good stuff there. But hey, Jeff. No, I already talked to Jeff. Hey, Henry, what you reading?
While we were on vacation week before last, I finished up South Pacific Air War by Michael Claringbold. This is a great series of books. It was supposed to be a trilogy. It's actually, there are 5 of them. But this guy's work is really good. Great, great illustrations, great detail. And then I finished that, and then I'm finishing up this book, Touched with Fire, The Land War in the South Pacific by Eric Bergerud. It was written back in the 90s. I've actually read it before, but I wanted to read it again. And it's really good. It talks mostly about New Guinea and the Solomon Islands, but Army and Marine action, but just a really good book drawing on some firsthand accounts of some tough fighting in New Guinea.
Fantastic. You have to let us know when that wraps up, how it all plays out. Hey, Ricky, what you reading?
What am I reading? I've got a couple of books, actually, that I'm reading. Can you give me a second to go get them?
Sure, I'll talk about mine.
I'll be back. Give me like about
20 cue up his song while he's doing that. If you've got Spotify, cue up his song.
There you go.
Well,
you may not be able to do it.
Well, I can do that, but somebody's got to talk now while I do it because I can't carry on a conversation.
Oh, I think Henry and I could take care of that.
Yeah,
right?
Go ahead.
Yeah,
go ahead.
I'd like to talk about Don complaining about spending $10 to send stickers to me when Henry sent me this beautiful painting of the airfield in Peleliu, and I didn't receive any complaints on that. I think it's crazy. I don't know.
I'm glad you like the painting. So,
oh man, absolutely, that's incredible. And yeah, so if people haven't seen on, I don't know if it was on What's the Scuttlebutt's social media or not, but yeah, Don cut us some really nice stickers, and I put a little message there: Loose Lips Sink Ships. But they also advertise for our podcast, so
yeah,
you know, for all of our listeners, we appreciate you guys buying our T-shirts and our stickers and. And, you know, word of mouth, especially, man, I've had so many people reaching out to us, you know, talking about how they missed us the past couple of weeks and they can't wait for our next episode. And
what's the old saying? Leave them wanting more.
Right.
Makes us feel like we're doing something right.
Yep.
That's right. That's right. All right, RT, what you got?
Okay.
Keep it clean.
Being an aspiring filmmaker, the thing that I've been studying most recently, I've already read a couple of books on Stanley Kubrick. This is a really good book, Kubrick Interviews. This one right here. And it's interviews that he did. And he was notoriously cagey about doing interviews because he hated doing interviews. Okay. He just liked making films, but he knew that it was an essential part of the process if you're a director of note, which he was. But, and then I read another book by Robert Rodriguez from the University of Texas Film School, you know, Dusk Till Dawn, you know, collaborator with Quentin Tarantino and all the other stuff.
Yep.
That's one of the books that inspired me to get into filmmaking. Right now, I'm reading this book about Francis Ford Coppola, and these are some of the photos that are inside of it. It's mostly a history of him and his work. And the other thing I'm reading is the script from one of his most notorious movies, Apocalypse Now, which was really actually an adaptation of Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness. So those are the books that I'm reading right now. I also have another book that I'm going to be reading. This is going to be a big read because it's really, really big. Sergio Leone.
Yes, the spaghetti westerns.
On death. Something to do with death. So I've obtained books, and I have this guy who gets me these books. He lives in Eugene, Oregon. His name is Ezra Tishman. And he is just fantastic. He's like an Eichmann on books. He can find a book so obscure that's hidden so well that you would never think that he'd be able to find it, but he can. So anyway, I'm doing that, and I'm trying to learn that aspect, the artistic and the storytelling aspects of making films. I already know the technical aspects of it and all the other stuff, but the thing is that one of the pivotal things about making a film is having a compelling story, being able to extract the performances from your artists, your actors, to capture something worthy of being captured on film, and being able to tell that story visually. So I'm learning from the best by reading about them and studying and watching their films as I have over the course of my life. So I'm just trying to stand on the shoulders of giants, as Wernher von Braun said, with the filmmaking thing, and do the best that I can. Jeff is actually going to be acting in the film. He's going to be playing one of the Pathfinders.
Fantastic.
And the thing is, we were supposed to get together this weekend, but got rained out. We will soon, when he comes back from his trip to New Jersey, we're going to come back and work on tossing some lines with the script. Everything will be finished with that sector of the script. It's a work in progress right now.
I want to take a real quick moment. This is brand new to the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast. This is a little segment I like to call, will we get a YouTube copyright strike when we have the artist on the show? Can you hear it?
Oh my God, that's my music!